All rise. The Chief Judge and the Associate Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. Today, your classroom serves as a federal courthouse for proceedings of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. We thank Dean Kramer and the faculty and staff and students for hosting today's outreach hearing. We shall now hear the appeal in United States against Lust. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Efron, members of the Honorable Court, may it please the court. There are several issues before this court, but the most decisive issue at stake is the appellant's constitutional right to confront the laboratory analysts whose testimonial statements were presented against him through the testimony of Dr. Smith and through the statements included within the Brooks Laboratory report. I would like to focus my argument on Dr. Smith's presenting testimonial hearsay produced through the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, otherwise known as AFIP, through their testing analysts. I will then discuss how testimonial portions of the Brooks drug testing lab were erroneously admitted, and this was plain error. When we consider this issue, it's important to consider confrontation. As the Supreme Court has said in Melendez-Diaz, it's useful in exposing an analyst's honesty, proficiency, and methodology. The military justice system is not immune from the fraudulent, incompetent, or sloppy analyst. For example, the USASIL analyst Philip Mills was revealed as one such fraudulent analyst. As we see in the Scrady case...
How do you deal with the opening door issue in this case? Is it your view that the defense counsel can never open the door to evidence such as this in rebuttal, that the Confrontation Clause trumps all?
You know, there are certain circumstances where the Confrontation Clause would be subject to rebuttal, but this is not one of them. For instance, I think of a situation where there might be some harassment of a witness. This is certainly not in that category.
Why didn't the appellant in this case, after having extensive discussion with the military judge about rebuttal and opening the door, not invite this issue by continuing on to ask questions?
Your Honor, the defense counsel had his obligation to present his client's interest, and to do that he was exposing some weaknesses in issues at the drug testing lab, and he was being zealous as his right and obligation is as an attorney.
Is the government supposed to just sit mum while the defense conducts a wholesale attack on methodology and workings at the lab? Is there any avenue open to the government? You're saying this is basically per se a confrontation violation. Are you? First of all, is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Then what's the government supposed to do? Well, can the government in any way effectively rebut it? And if so, how?
Your Honor, the government could easily have brought in the AFIP analyst in this case, Amber Dixon, and that would have complied with the Confrontation Clause. That was a decision of theirs not to do that, and they knew...
What was she supposed to testify to? She's the one who laid hands on it, right?
From the report, Your Honor, she was the analyst who performed the...
But it's rebuttal, so what the government's supposed to do is ask for a recess and then go call the rebuttal witness to come in?
Your Honor,
suspend the trial for, 3 days or something while you get the right witness in?
Your Honor, I think the government does have an obligation to get their witnesses and have their strategy in
But
advance.
It's a rebuttal witness. It was the defense that opened the door. Should the government have anticipated that it was defense counsel who would bring before the members the actual test score?
Your Honor, I do think that in terms of a rebuttal, the actual score didn't come in until the cross-examination after the government had, through their expert, had mentioned the AFIP. And at that point, the defense counsel and the trial defense counsel was doing damage control, if you will. At that point, the military judge had let it come in.
What what particular bits of actual testimonial hearsay did he bring in? What did he repeat? Are you saying he served as a conduit?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, what did he serve as a conduit for? What went in that shouldn't have gone in?
He testified that there was a test that was confirmation. It was a GCMS test, and he testified that it was positive for BZE. Under HARCO, this particular test was conducted in a situation where the results were generated specifically for court-martial use. In fact, charges had already been referred when the trial counsel specifically requested a retest to rebut defense allegations of lab mishandling. So this was generated by the prosecution in order to generate evidence.
Okay, we're not talking about the Brooks test here. We're talking about the AFib test.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
Could you point counsel specifically when you say the GCMS test, the confirmatory test, what specific portion of the drug testing report are you referring to? Because, as you know, some of the evidence in the drug testing report is just machine-generated results, and some of it is not. And so what specifically in the drug testing report are you relying on for your assertion that there was testimonial evidence elicited with respect to the AFib test?
Your Honor, there's a cover of the letter, and it talks about there being a test, and it was positive. That for certain is testimonial. Also,
you would agree that the drug testing report itself was not admitted in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. There's also a linkage that connects the sample that was tested to the appellant through a number, and that's also testimonial. And that's included on the chromatographs on the page.
So it's the linkage of the Social Security number to the test result?
It's not the Social Security number, Your Honor. It's a different number that's actually on the report for the AFib test. It's not a social, it's not on the specimen.
Okay. And what's your authority for saying that's testimonial? The number?
Well, it's not something that the expert who testified would have any knowledge of. So he basically looked at the report, and he's basically relaying the same information that's in the report, which AFib determined the value of. And he was not a part of the actual test.
Okay, are the raw data testimonial?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Is the chain of custody testimonial?
Your Honor, the chain of custody could...
Without more?
Without more, it's certainly a matter that could be testimonial.
Didn't the Supreme Court say it went to weight, not admissibility?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Then how's the testimonial?
In this particular case, to actually connect the number identified with the appellant for the AFib test is a testimonial statement that the expert, Dr. Smith, wouldn't have knowledge of.
Counsel, if that's the case, why aren't all business records then testimonial? If you don't have the ability to use the record itself in terms of identifying what the record relates to, then what good is the business record exception?
Well, Your Honor, it's actually an evidentiary exception. Obviously, in this particular case, this is a confrontation issue, Your Honor, which subsumes the evidentiary issue.
I understand that. But if you have a record that's given to an expert, how would the expert know that that record is pertinent to the particular case unless there's an identifying number on it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And if the expert can't use that and then testify that he relied upon that in the course of making his evaluation, and you have to bring in somebody from the lab to identify the underlying record as being pertinent to the case, then there's no point to any of the exception for the business record, is there? Because there's no longer a business record exception. Instead, you're having to bring in somebody to go through the business record and explain what it is.
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, certainly the cover page was testimonial for the AFib test, and the judge actually determined...
What was testimonial about it other than the identifying number?
The results itself, Your Honor.
Okay. So you're not relying then solely on the identifying number?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay.
Counsel, what if there is information that's contained in the computer-generated reports and in the chain of custody reports, but is also contained in the cover memorandum? Does the fact that it's in the cover memorandum then make it testimonial and protected?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that depends on the situation. I think it could.
Well, but if it's If it's not testimonial, I mean, if we've established that the computer-generated information is not testimonial, so that should be admissible. But if that same information is then found in the cover memorandum, isn't it still admissible? Does the cover memorandum somehow vest that with the confrontation protection, even though it's available somewhere else?
Your Honor, I think that it would still be testimonial for the cover memorandum. Outside the cover memorandum, it depends on the circumstances.
Well, counsel, wouldn't, and I'm asking you, not telling you, but if you have testimonial evidence on one page and non-testimonial evidence on other pages, and it's the same information, wouldn't that go to whether it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, Your Honor, but again, certainly the number is testimonial. Identifying this particular sample with a particular number is not something that the expert would know.
With respect to the first question that Judge Baker was asking you, am I understanding you correctly that your position is that regardless of the timing of the evidence, whether it's rebuttal evidence or evidence on direct examination, that doesn't change whether it's testimonial or non-testimonial?
I'm going to repeat that question, Your Honor, to make sure I understand.
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand when Judge Baker was asking you about the fact that this evidence came in and that some of the evidence came in on rebuttal, am I understanding you correctly that your position is that that doesn't matter with respect to the testimonial nature of the
yes,
evidence?
Sir. Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming that you're correct that it was testimonial.
Yes, Your Honor. Like in the Cromer case, the Confrontation Clause remains. The Confrontation Clause is not subject to the vagaries of the rules of evidence.
Is the defense conceding that this is proper rebuttal testimony? Let's say, assuming no Confrontation Clause problem, would this be proper rebuttal testimony here?
No, Your Honor.
Then why wouldn't it be proper rebuttal in this case? What would be your argument in that regard? I didn't see it in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor. In this particular case, the defense attacked the Brooks laboratory and exposed some weaknesses. And the government certainly had the option to bring in other individuals at Brooks if they wanted to get this test in. They chose not to. This was just a strategic decision that the government made. Actually, they could have brought this witness in during their case in chief, but they elected not to.
I don't think that's answering my question. My question is, was this or was this not the AFib test, the second test, was it or was it not proper rebuttal testimony, putting aside the issue of confrontation?
Yes, sir, and I think it could be.
So you agree that it was proper rebuttal testimony?
Yes, sir, it could be.
Thank you.
Okay. Counsel, the defense counsel, when specifically asked whether he objected to the Brooks lab results, said, "No, Your Honor, I don't." Why isn't that waiver?
Your Honor, this is a case of forfeiture. This was in 2008, and this was before Melendez-Diaz. At that time, the Blazier case.
It was after Crawford, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they had an extensive discussion about Blazier Crawford. And it happens that the urinalysis in this case was the very day that cert was granted on Melendez-Diaz. So why wasn't counsel on notice that these issues were in play?
Your Honor, I think that in the military system at that time, Blazier had been decided about 2 months before.
And didn't Blazier explicitly leave the door open for a whole bunch of issues?
It was an Air Force Court decision, but it basically said in the Blazier case, which involved, I believe it was...
Which Blazier case?
Blazier 1, which is the Air Force case.
The Air Force Court.
It basically said that in that similar situation, I believe it was a random UA, that the statements were, the lab reports were non-testimonial. And this was 2 months before this actual case came to trial. There was Harcro, of course, but Harcro was a different situation that was based on a sample being identified and based on an investigation.
But defense counsel clearly knew that these issues were in flux and in play.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that the defense counsel was aware of any other service courts or in the military system that would have recognized that.
Defense counsel engaged in a lengthy discussion with the military judge and trial counsel about Crawford.
Yes, Your Honor.
It is not as if that snuck up on defense counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. Melendez-Diaz adopted a new constitutional rule, particularly...
The court in Melendez-Diaz expressly eschewed adopting a new constitutional rule. They said this is nothing but a gloss on Crawford.
Your Honor, I believe they actually used the phrase, we adopt a constitutional rule. And although, Your Honor, they also said they apply Crawford. And it's a straightforward application of Crawford. In this case, this court in Blazier overturned the Air Force Court case, which was the circuit court's ruling at the time of this court-martial.
Okay, then let me push it one step further. Assuming it's forfeiture and not waiver, how can there be plain error? The state of the law was in flux then. The state of the law is obviously in flux now. How can there be plain error?
Under Blazier, Your Honor, we know that that cover memorandum for your analysis tests, especially random your analysis tests, is testimonial. And so it's clear now, and at the time, Blazier had a different opinion, and that was the service court's decision to landscape.
Well, no, but the state of the law as a whole is in flux. Otherwise, why are we here? And otherwise, why did the Supreme Court grant cert and argue bullcoming? Wouldn't you agree that the state of the law in this area is in significant flux?
Yes, Your Honor, there have been...
Okay, then how can there be plain error? You can't misapply law that isn't clear. You're the judge. You know, the law has got to be clear for you to misapply it.
Right, Your Honor. At the time of the trial, the judge did not make an error, but we apply the law as it is today and on appeal. And
that's not response to my question. My question is the law is in flux today, and we apply a law that's in flux, so how can there be plain error?
Your Honor, I think it's clear that the Cupper Memorandum was testimonial, and I think that's clear from the Blazier decision.
Are all certifications formalized testimonial materials?
No, sir. It depends on the circumstances. In this particular situation, there's a certification by the lab certifying official, Jai Dev. And in this case, he...
I tried the question in generic form first before... Sure. Jumping into this particular certification. So your first answer is not all certifications are formalized testimonial materials. Which ones are and why, before you apply your statement of law to the facts of this case?
Sure. I think
because I'm going to guess that this certification review is, but I want to know what standard of law you're applying.
It depends if they're made under the circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe the statement would be available for use at a later trial.
So it doubles back to that prong of the original Crawford analysis.
Yes, Your Honor. There's also, if it's a functional affidavit, that can also be another reason. The certification by Jai Dev.
Is it your view that the certification on DOD Form 2624 in the bottom is an affidavit, or is it this category of under a circumstance that
it's both, Your Honor.
Blah blah blah.
It's both. It's an unsworn. It's a functional equivalent of an unsworn affidavit.
Counsel, is the waiver issue essential for you to prevail in this case? That is, assuming that the defense either waived or forfeited the challenge to the first drug test. Does that preclude you from making an argument as to the admissibility of the second drug test in light of the confrontation clause?
Your Honor, I see my time is up.
You can answer that question.
It does not, if there was a forfeiture or a waiver on the first issue, it does not have an impact on the second issue, the viability of the second
and
issue.
And just elaborate why.
Because the second issue, which is the AFIP retest, and this is a retest that stands on its fours. It was still tested under circumstances where it was requested by the trial counsel and under Hargrove as testimonial. And furthermore, there was no limiting instruction. There were multiple references during the closing argument. This particular result was used for the truth of the matter asserted, not merely as the basis for the expert's opinion.
Well, and they objected to it.
Yes, Your Honor. There was an objection to it. Yes, Your Honor.
If we were to get to harmless error analysis, what impact, if any, would the nature, volume, and of the members' questions have on that? The military judge in this case took note of the fact that the members were exceedingly active participants in this process. Does that have any bearing at all in the harmlessness analysis, either way or none?
You know, I think if anything, it would show that they had some questions about the government's case, and they were not convinced that the government had met its burden.
So that's how you'd interpret the nature and the number of the questions?
Yes, Your Honor.
You have further opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the amicus.
You're going to take up most of your time getting there.
Chief Judge Efron, and may it please the court, Greg Young, appearing under the supervision of George Fisher on behalf of Amicus Curiae. As reflected in our brief, I've chosen to address only one of the specified issues in this case. The military judge erred in admitting the testimony of Dr. Smith regarding the AFib test results. That error violated the Confrontation Clause, and that error cannot be held harmless. The Confrontation Clause violation in this case occurred when the military judge permitted Dr. Smith to testify on direct examination for rebuttal that AFib had conducted a test of appellant's urine and that that test showed the urine to contain BZE. Dr. Smith could not have made that statement based either on his own direct personal knowledge or by drawing his own expert conclusions from the material that was presented to him in the report. Therefore, the only other option is that he was serving as a conduit for the testimonial hearsay of someone else.
Wait, are you saying he could not have read all those graphs and come up with the conclusion on his own?
Your Honor, that is exactly what I'm saying. He could have read all those graphs and come up with the conclusion that some test apparently had been conducted and that the results of that graph were looked like what he would expect to see if a properly conducted test was run on someone's specimen that contained BZE. But he could not have testified based solely on the graph that a test had actually been conducted, as opposed to someone just photocopying a graph from another test and sticking it into the packet, or that that test actually was run on appellant's urine, or that it showed the presence of benzoylic gonine. Furthermore, implicit in his statement, implicit in his statement that it showed benzoylic gonine and the fact that he was basing his opinion upon it was the statement that this test was properly conducted. And that also is something he could not have concluded solely by looking at the machine-generated graphs.
Now, if an expert is asked to give an opinion on test one and test two also exists, how does then the proponent produce that test two for purposes of an expert looking at it? And yet, is the expert precluded from looking at it until a witness appears in court and shows the entire chain of custody, or alternatively, can the expert look at it but can't testify until you also get a chain of custody person in court?
Your Honor, Dr. Smith was completely justified in looking at the report and in relying upon it when he expressed his opinion. However, the prosecution violated the Confrontation Clause by introducing the underlying fact that there was such a report and testimony regarding it through Dr. Smith. The appropriate means for them to introduce those underlying facts into evidence would have been to call at least the lab analyst, Amber Dixon.
You're arguing that he didn't have direct knowledge that it was appellant's urine. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes, Your Honor. Among
so
other
he
things.
Could argue that whatever this piece of paper says this, but I don't have direct knowledge that it's linked to this appellant, with the accused.
That's correct, Your Honor.
How would the lab analyst know that it's appellant's urine? Lab analyst, I would venture to say, based upon the urinalysis cases we see, is highly unlikely to have been present when the urine was produced.
Your Honor, that is true. However, the lab analyst could at least have testified that she received a sample that was identified as appellant's and that it was, in fact, that sample that she put into the machine using proper procedures, and that the results that are in that package are the results that the machine spit out after testing that sample.
Well, how is she going to know whether somebody made a Xerox copy, which you seem to say is also a problem?
Your Honor, she would presumably have been the person to take that paper off the machine, as well as to tell the machine whose specimen it was testing.
Counsel, let me ask you to step back and approach this a slightly different way, just to test the limits of what it is that you're arguing here today. What, in your view, if anything, could this witness have been asked about with respect to the AFib test?
Your Honor, I believe that it would have violated the Confrontation Clause for Dr. Smith to offer any testimony that would have clearly suggested to the jury that there was a second test out there that had shown that the appellant tested positive. He was completely justified in basing his opinion upon it. If the prosecution had gone so far as to ask him a question to the nature of Dr. Smith, informing your opinion, have you reviewed all the reports and other documentation made available to you? And he had, yes, I do not believe that would have violated the Confrontation Clause. But as soon as he made it clear that there was another test out there that confirmed the results of the first test, the Confrontation Clause line was clearly crossed.
Well, what's your view with respect to his testimony with respect to the Brooks Lab report? I know that that wasn't the issue that you wrote on, but do you have a view with respect to that report? And if you're not prepared to discuss it, just say so. I'm not trying to put you in an uncomfortable situation.
Your Honor, I am not prepared to discuss the plain error and forfeiture issues. However, with respect to the report itself, laying aside the plain error and the forfeiture analysis, I think the situation is exactly the same. Again, Dr. Smith was making statements he could not possibly have made either from direct personal knowledge or from his own expert conclusions.
Well, how do you square that with this Court's opinions in Blazer 1 and Blazer 2, where I think we made it fairly clear that we did not think that it was problematic for an expert to repeat non-testimonial hearsay? And in our view, some of the material contained within a drug testing report, because recall that is something in Blazer that we did, is we disaggregated the report into different pieces, right? And we said some of the pieces are not testimonial, and if they're not testimonial, then an expert can talk about them to his heart's content.
Your Honor, I think this case follows straight from this Court's opinion in Blazer 2. What this Court noted in Blazer 2 is that there are machine-generated, non-testimonial, or to be more accurate, non-hearsay portions of the report, to which Dr. Smith could have testified to his heart's content. He could have said to the jury, I have a graph in front of me. I have no idea to whose specimen it pertains, but this graph looks like the graph I would expect from a test of urine that contained BZE.
Could he say, and it is recorded that it's a specimen of number 14397?
Your Honor, to the extent that the jury would be able to identify that number with the appellant, which I'm assuming is the background to your question, then he is a conduit for someone else's testimonial hearsay.
What if it's spit out as part of the machine-generated data report?
Your Honor, Dr. Smith made it verbally clear to the judge that the GCMS machine cannot identify the specimen that it is testing and that it relies upon the technician. So those labels at the tops of the graphs are the result of human input. So that is computer stored, but not machine generated.
Okay. What does the judge do when the defense says, Your Honor, I object to that testimony that you've just said that the expert could give, that is relaying what he saw in the graphs, because the expert can't relate that particular graph to the person who's being tried here today. Therefore, it's not relevant at all. Even for an expert to use as the basis for his or her opinion.
Your Honor,
the defense is saying this is just some random piece of paper out there. If it can't be linked up, how can it be testified to?
Your Honor, to the extent that Dr. Smith would be unable to lay a foundation for that graph by itself, if that graph had been sort of abstracted from the report with no identifying information, the defense counsel would have a valid lack of foundation objection. But that isn't a Confrontation Clause issue.
With respect to the AFib report, can you point me to where in the record it is that the doctor connected this particular sample or test to the appellant in the case?
Yes,
because
Your Honor.
My recollection is, my reading of the record is that it was the defense counsel that made that connection.
Your Honor, I'm referring to page 344 of the Joint Appendix. And this is Dr. Smith testifying on the initial direct examination rebuttal. And in response to trial counsel's question, what else he might have based his opinion on, he stated, the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, where I work, also tested a portion of that specimen. and he therefore clearly linked it to the appellant. I mean, the statement, that specimen, made it absolutely clear that he was talking about the urine that was at issue in this case and not some random person.
What's your response to Justice Breyer's question during the Bull Cumming argument as to whether a nurse's documentation or lab person's documentation of medical services provided, say, when a rape victim comes in, is or is not testimonial?
Your Honor, I have 10 seconds remaining.
You've got plenty of time. That's a great. You could write an opinion.
You can take the time you need to answer Judge Baker's question, then you'll also have an opportunity to briefly sum up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now I can fill it out if you want some more or not.
Would you please, Your Honor?
Stall time to think.
Yeah.
In that case, for example, the nurse knows or the treating person knows that they're dealing with a potential rape victim, but it's not like the AFIP test, for example, where they know the person is being charged or the charging decision has already been made or the person's already under investigation, right? They haven't determined yet that a rape has occurred, for example, but they know that if a rape has occurred, that's why they're doing the testing and all that. Is there a meaningful distinction for Crawford purposes between the Breyer scenario and the AFAP test, in your view?
Your Honor, Melendez-Diaz...
Was that okay? Did that give
yes,
you
sir.
Enough time to think?
Yes, Your Honor. Melendez-Diaz states that the test is whether the statement is made under circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that the statements would be available for later use at trial. And as you formulated the question, it's clear that the nurse or other examining person of a rape victim would know that their statements would clearly be relevant to a later trial and would be available for such use. So, yes, I would imagine they would have to fall under the purview of the confrontation.
Would Bryant have any effect on that?
No, Your Honor. Bryant reiterates that the evidentiary purpose or primary purpose test is how we know what is testimonial, but it in no way disturbs Melendez-Diaz. If anything, it reinforces it.
What about the case of a child who comes in and has a spiral fracture in their leg, which may or may not indicate some sort of child abuse? Let's stipulate, just for the purpose of this question, that sometimes spiral fractures are indicative of a certain kind of abuse, and sometimes they represent a kid who fell down the stairs.
Your Honor, at that point, this is when Michigan versus Bryant would become relevant, because the court reiterated there that it is the purpose of the declarant and not the person who is asking the questions or the situation which is causing the question to be asked, by analogy here, that determines whether or not that statement is testimonial. So in that case, a court would have to look to the sort of the internal thoughts of the declarant and also the objective circumstances to determine whether or not the person examining that child would have thought their statements might be available for use at trial.
Well, I think you need to be careful in how you're characterizing that case, counsel, because I don't think that it stands for the proposition that if, for example, the objective circumstances would lead a reasonable objective person to believe that their statement would be available for use at a later trial, that the fact that the declarant himself didn't expect that it would make it non-testimonial. Do you understand the distinction?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree.
You may briefly sum up.
Your Honor, Dr. Smith's statements clearly introduced the testimonial hearsay of Amber Dixon. The error cannot be held harmless in that this was one of only two pieces of evidence, and the government's only other piece of evidence had been heavily undermined. For those reasons, amicus curiae requests that this court set aside appellant's findings and sentence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, counsel.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. I'm Major Mendelson, and together with Colonel Christensen, I represent the United States in this case. I'll begin by addressing the Brooks Lab Report. Appellant has waived the Confrontation Clause issue with respect to the Brooks Lab Report because he did not object to the admission of the report at trial.
Are you going first with this because it's your strongest argument, or for some other reason?
Well, I guess with respect to why I'm addressing the Brooks Lab report first, mostly for chronological reasons, but waiver with respect to the Brooks Lab report, I think it's a strong issue, and that's why I'm addressing waiver before the remainder of the issues with respect to the Brooks Lab report.
The defense has made an argument that even if waived or forfeited, there was material in the AFIP report that was not proper rebuttal with respect to admissibility under the Confrontation Clause. Why don't you go ahead and address that? And assuming that it was waived.
Assuming
that the first test, the Brooks test, and the admissibility of that was waived by the defense, then address the question of whether the AFIP report and the testimony that relates to the AFIP report from the expert was subject to objection under the Confrontation Clause.
Yes, Your Honor.
Move on to the other issue.
I got it. Thank you. The AFIP, Dr. Smith properly disclosed the AFIP test result as part of the basis of his opinion. The trial defense counsel in this case vigorously attacked the reliability of the Brooks Lab with 37 different discrepancy reports during the cross-examination of Dr.
Smith. Just to be clear, just address both the result, but he also disclosed, as I understand the appellant's brief, they're taking issue not just with the fact that he indicated the nature of the result, positive, but also spoke to the validity of the process itself. Do you follow?
I
would ask if you could please address both to the extent they're not the exact same argument.
Yes, Your Honor. I think what's important to keep in mind here is that on rebuttal direct, the trial counsel carefully elicited the testimony regarding the AFIP test result in the context of what the expert considered informing his opinion regarding the reliability of the Brooks result. The trial counsel asked Dr. Smith what he considered in reaching his opinion that the Brooks lab was a reliable result, and Dr. Smith responded that he also considered the GCMS test by AFIP that showed the presence of BCE. That was the extent of the testimony that was elicited by trial counsel on rebuttal direct.
If that's the case, let's take a look at page 38 of your brief, where you say, as discussed in issue one, the AFIP confirmation test was wholly consistent with the defense theory of unknowing ingestion and did not undermine the defense attempt to attack the handling of the samples at the Brooks lab, since the sample tested by the AFIP was poured and shipped from the Brooks lab. If it didn't undermine it, how could it be proper rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. It was proper rebuttal with respect to the fact that Dr. Smith's expert testimony was attacked with respect to the basis of his testimony.
Right, but the basis of his testimony that you're relying on was his testimony that there was a reliable lab at Brooks. And here you're saying that it didn't undermine his defense attempt to attack the handling of the samples at Brooks. Is that consistent? Or is what about your argument on page 38 in terms of whether this was proper rebuttal or not?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe it's a consistent argument because those are two distinct issues. The reliability of the tests performed at the Brooks lab is a distinct issue from the issue as to whether or not there could have been some kind of external contamination of appellant's urine sample. And so the defense counsel presented the theory at trial that either there was an unknowing or innocent ingestion or that there could have been some kind of external contamination of appellant's urine sample.
Are you referring to something external to the Brooks lab or an external factor that contaminated the material at the Brooks lab?
An external factor. So by external, I mean rather than ingestion, the actual urine specimen itself becoming contaminated either through
right.
the collection process or the only place it could be contaminated at the Brooks lab is the specimen processing room because that sample never leaves the specimen processing room.
And if the Brooks lab allowed for external contamination at that lab, doesn't that undermine the reliability of the lab?
That would undermine the reliability with respect to contamination, but the discrepancy reports, the 37 discrepancy reports that the defense counsel used to cross-examine Dr. Smith with, were not all focused on potential contamination. They were discrepancy reports that dealt with other steps within the testing process at the Brooks lab, including pouring errors and labeling errors and misplacing of test tubes, misidentification, et cetera.
And how does the result in the AFib test rebut any of that? The only way it rebuts it is to say, well, we got a second test, that's good, so I'm an expert and I'm going to rely on that. Why doesn't that also address the issue of contamination?
Well, if I understand Your Honor's question, because the aliqua that is sent to the AFib lab for testing is poured from the same urine specimen that exists at Brooks Lab. Brooks Lab poured that urine specimen from the specimen processing room and sent it to AFib for testing. So the confirmation test at the AFib lab is one of another, it's actually the fourth test that's conducted on appellant's urine, because at the Brooks lab there's the initial immunoassay, the rescreen immunoassay, and then the GCMS test. Each one of those individual tests, the aliquot for that test is poured from the original specimen that never leaves the specimen processing room.
Can I ask about the military judge finding number one was that the AFib test was a confirmatory test, and that distinguishes this case from Harcrow and Crawford and other cases. Why does the fact that it's a confirmatory test answer or not answer the confrontation question?
The way that I understood that portion of the military judge's ruling was that that was part and parcel of his finding that the AFib test was coming in to explain to the members the basis upon which Dr. Smith formed his opinion regarding the presence of DZE in appellant sample and the reliability of the.
So you're saying it does or does not have anything to do with the Crawford analysis?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
So how does that relate to Crawford analysis? The judge seems to have relied upon it to answer the Crawford question.
Well,
I don't understand how it answers the Crawford question. Either it's testimonial or it isn't. The fact that it's confirming a fact doesn't mean it's not testimonial.
The way I understood that, the link to Crawford or the relationship to Crawford is that because this is coming in, the AFib confirmation test is coming in as basis evidence to help to explain to the members the basis of Dr. Smith's opinion that the Brooks lab result itself is reliable. It is not coming in as hearsay. If it's not hearsay, it can't be testimonial hearsay.
But why aren't we looking at what the purpose of the confirmatory test was? I mean, we're talking about whether that test was itself testimonial or non-testimonial, or whether portions of it were or were not. And when you have a confirmatory test requested by the government, you know, in order to rebut a defense claim that the original tests were not properly conducted, how can you say that the AFib test in whole or in part is not testimonial?
Well, I think the distinction there is that the AFib drug testing report didn't come in. That's a separate issue. The AFib drug testing report, the conclusions contained within that court report would be testimonial because it would fall under this court's analysis in Harcrow because it was specifically requested for use in prosecution. So it answers that question of testimonial in the affirmative because that report was produced in anticipation of prosecution.
Okay, so step one, some portion at least of the AFib test you would agree is testimonial. And so, given that fact, take us from that to why Dr. Smith repeating information from that same test in whole or in part is not testimonial. And I don't think the answer can be because it was in rebuttal. I mean, it is either testimonial or it's not testimonial.
Because Dr. Smith didn't repeat any statement within the AFib drug test report. I think it's important to note that just because an expert reviews raw data or machine-generated data from a lab report and happens to come to the same conclusion that the declarant who wrote the cover page for that drug report came to doesn't mean that expert merely just repeated that testimonial hearsay. So while there would be testimonial hearsay in the AFIP drug test report, we know from the Article 39A session with Dr. Smith prior to his testimony on rebuttal that he had reviewed the actual test data, the machine-generated data, and that's how he reached his conclusion that the AFIP test did show the presence of DCE.
With respect to whether the AFIP test was properly conducted in accordance with proper procedures, can you point me to the pages that are machine-generated that he relied on as opposed to some other information?
I'm not sure that I'm prepared to point, Your Honor, to particular pages, but I do think in answer to that question, Dr. Smith relied upon the GCMS data, and certainly he would have relied upon some chain of custody information because he would have to know that that was appellant's sample. However, the government doesn't believe that the chain of custody information itself is testimonial information. It's rather normal documentation that the lab technicians do contemporaneously with the testing process to ensure the scientific accuracy of their...
Does that include Block 11?
I'm sorry, Block 11 of...
Is the certification thing at the bottom that says I certified the lab process was conducted as appropriate or whatever?
And,
I'll read it to you.
And, Your Honor, you're talking about the AFIP or the Brooks?
I'm anyone because it's a standard DD form 2624. certification, I certify that I am a laboratory certifying official, that the laboratory results indicated on this form were correctly determined by proper laboratory procedures and they are correctly annotated. Is your statement that is a testimonial statement or not? Regardless of where it appears, I will make it up some new exhibit. It's a hypothetical question. Were that to appear in a document, would that be a testimonial statement?
No, Your Honor, that wouldn't be a testimonial statement.
Why not?
Because the lab technician is making that statement contemporaneously with the testing process itself.
But what does that have to do with anything?
Well, because the lab technician is not making that statement.
Well, why would a lab
with an eye towards prosecution, but making that statement because they're a forensic lab and to ensure the scientific accuracy.
Well, let's go to the actual test. Is what would an objective person reasonably believe that this would be available for use at trial? And if the answer is no, why the heck are they making the statement?
Because they're a forensic laboratory, and here's what the lab technicians
and
know.
Excuse me, counsel. Don't interrupt me. What is the purpose of a forensic lab?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize. The statements that they're making, the purpose of those statements is because they know that they are constantly evaluated for scientific accuracy. The reasonable lab technician has no idea of knowing which one of many thousands of samples will ever test positive and what small percentage of those that do test positive will ever go to prosecution.
Counsel, can I interrupt you and ask, does that include the test that is confirmatory? So that response seems to be directed towards a unit sweep type situation where you have all these samples. What about a situation where the lab technician knows this has been requested for the purpose of investigation or court-martial?
So, in a situation in which the lab technician knows that it was requested for purposes of a court-martial, that is a different factual situation in which an objective lab technician, knowing that it was requested for use in a court-martial, would understand that their statement...
So, in your view... Is it in your view? Is Block 11 is not inherently testimonial nor not testimonial, but depends on context. That's a question.
Yep, I believe that's a fair characterization of the case law. Yes, sure.
But it could be
under certain circumstances.
And then where are we with the AFIP certification? Is that testimonial or not? based upon the request for the second test?
Based upon the request for the second test, that certification could be viewed as testimonial. But I think the important point for purposes of this case is that that's not something that was relayed by Dr. Smith in his testimony. He didn't serve as a conduit of that testimonial hearsay.
Wasn't he asked by defense counsel about the whether the lab procedures were adhered to? And I was trying to find the page.
My recollection is that he said in response to that that he relied upon all of the certifications that were in the underlying documentation.
He was asked by defense counsel that question, right. But it was defense counsel that asked that question and elicited that testimony.
But again, does it matter? Does it matter who asked the question? I mean, it doesn't change the nature of whether the answer relies on or repeats or is based upon solely testimonial evidence.
Your Honor, I think it does matter who asked the question because.
Can you just? And I don't mean to interrupt you. I apologize, but if you could explain why you think it matters.
Because the defense can always waive the right to confrontation, and if the defense elicits that testimony, then the defense can't then turn around and complain of that testimony as being in violation of the confrontation clause.
But I think in a case like this where the defense objected entirely to any discussion of the AFIP report and objected entirely to any of this, and where the military judge initially agreed with the defense counsel, that it's a pretty hard argument to say that they've waived it in this case because they are now defending themselves with respect to a report that they didn't want referenced at all.
Well, I don't think it's a hard argument when you look at what the trial counsel asked on rebuttal direct. It was barely over a page of testimony, and it was very carefully tailored to only elicit that basis evidence.
But the evidence that they elicited, right? We would agree was strong evidence in light of all the irregularities with respect to the Brooks Lab testing process, was strong confirmatory evidence that, you know, despite all the glitches that had happened throughout the testing process and the lack of timely certifications with respect to the machines, that none of that mattered because we have a confirmatory test from AFIS.
I agree that result was very probative of the reliability of the Brooks test.
And that was what the trial counsel wanted to get out, and that's what the trial counsel got out.
That's what the trial counsel was allowed to get out after the defense counsel, knowing that the AFIP confirmation test was out there and having been put on notice by the military judge that he could open the door to that test result, vigorously attacked the reliability of the Brooks lab.
Counsel, a question about the instructional issue. What standard do you think the judge applied here?
With respect to the instructional issue?
Yeah. Do you apply 403, 703, some hybrid, or what?
Oh, so the balancing test on letting basis evidence come in. I agree that, unfortunately,
leaving aside invited error, and I know the government is arguing invited error, but leaving aside invited error, what do you think the judge did, or can we tell as a reviewing court?
I think that the judge applied the 703 balancing test. I think the judge misspoke when he said he was applying 403.
Which the defense had also misspoken about.
Presumably.
Okay, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. But in any event, even if this court was to consider the balancing test de novo, appellant himself concedes that after the cross-examination of Dr. Smith, the AFIP result became very probative of the reliability of the Brooks lab. When you balance that against any danger of unfair prejudice, I think that the balance tilts.
What you're saying is that the appellant says, yeah, that's quite probative stuff, and that therefore it would in any event satisfy the 703 test by virtue of its probative nature.
Well, the court still has to consider and balance that against unfair prejudice. But again, because the main defense in this case, and really the only strong defense in this case would have been unknowing ingestion. And that's the defense that the members were most focused on. If you look at the court member questions in this case, the majority of those questions involved how BZE could be present other than knowingly ingesting cocaine. That unknowing ingestion defense was in no way undermined or impaired by the confirmation test because, in other words, if the appellant had unknowingly come into contact with cocaine, of course, that later confirmatory test at AFIP would show the presence of BZE.
As the defense argued on appeal, that the unknowing ingestion defense is at issue with respect to the what they view as the objectionable admission of the AFIP test? As I understand the defense argument on appeal is that the admission of the AFIP test undermined their ability to attack the reliability of the Brooks lab because it gave strong evidence of the reliability of the Brooks lab. Their objection is that the evidence was too probative and that in the absence of confrontation it shouldn't be allowed in. I didn't understand them arguing that issue with respect to the unknowing ingestion defense.
I agree that with respect to this appeal, their argument is that their attack on the Brooks lab was undermined by the AFIP confirmation test. But I think at trial, the strongest defense that they were setting forth, the defense that the trial defense counsel started with in his opening statement and focused on in his closing argument, and the defense that the court members were clearly most interested in by the content of their questions, was the unknowing ingestion defense.
Under what theory do we rely solely on the members' questions to rule out another basis of defense? How do we know that the members might not have been even more concerned about the reliability, but the particular questions that were on their mind that they were uncertain about related to the unknowing ingestion?
Well, I don't know that there's a particular theory, and I don't know that there's any way to say with any certainty, but I do think it's fair to consider the contents of the members' questions as a strong indication of what is on the members' minds.
No further questions from my colleagues. You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. The government asserts that the appellant waived the Confrontation Clause issue with respect to the Brooks Lab test, even if not waived, that the admission of the cover memorandum of the Brooks test was not plain or obvious error because there's no indication that it was produced as a result of a request for use in a court-martial. And in any event, it would be harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. The government also asserts that the AFIP test was properly disclosed as basis evidence after Dr. Smith's opinion was vigorously attacked on cross-examination. The government respectfully requests that this court affirm the conviction and sentence in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'd just like to clarify the defense's point on opening the door. The Kramer case is instructive here.
Counsel, I can't understand.
The Kramer case is instructive here. It's a circuit opinion case. The proper rebuttal for the government on the attack at Brooks would have been to bring in evidence of proper handling of the samples at Brooks. And there were, in no sense did the defense's cross-examination open up basically a loss of their confrontation rights under the completeness theory.
Well, isn't a confirmatory test evidence of proper handling or at least evidence of consistency?
Of a consistent result, although there was a significant differential.
You're speaking very loudly. I can't hear part of what you're saying.
Your Honor, my apologies.
I'm sorry.
You might want to lift your microphone up. You're a little, yeah, little taller.
Sure. There were significant differences in the nanogram level between the two tests. They were both positive. In this case, the result of the second test would come in not merely as a basis, but for the truth of the matter asserted, and was presented as such in closing argument.
What's your response, counsel, to the government's argument that with respect to that piece of what you believe is testimonial going to the proper handling of the AFIP test versus the amount or the positive nature of it. Why did or did not the defense counsel waive the confrontation issue with respect to that? Do you know what I'm...
I don't think I understand.
This is page 437 of the record, and the military judge has previously said, look, counsel, you can bring this in, but you can't bring anything else in. And then it's the defense counsel who asks, and are you relying upon the fact that these things were properly done, but there were no problems for the validity of that report? Argue. I'm not sure what that means. Answer, that is correct. I am relying on the fact that they follow the SOP. Now, why is that, to the extent that is testimonial, why is it, and it's defense counsel that's brought it out, why isn't that a case of waiving the confrontation with respect to that issue?
Well, Your Honor, I believe this is on cross-examination, and
it's
different than the issue that was brought before the members, and basically the cat was out of the bag when the military judge let the...
So once one piece of testimonial evidence is in, then defense can bring it all in and then later object that it was brought in.
Your Honor, the original objection was the initial one, and at that point it was damage control.
Is that rule of completeness? Is that an issue here? That is, that is the defense position that the defense had to bring that evidence up because otherwise the response of the witness was not complete, or was the defense bringing it up for some other reason?
No, Your Honor, I sense that the defense counsel wanted to expose the lack of real knowledge of that expert, and that's the core of this case. I see my time is up.
You can answer the question, then you have an opportunity to briefly conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. My sense is that the defense counsel wanted to expose the fact that this expert was not familiar with the actual test and was relying on the statements of the actual analysts themselves. If the analysts were fraudulent, then it was pretty much an assumption that, you know, the expert is just kind of going with their words. May I briefly conclude? Military Rule of Evidence 703 cannot be used to circumvent the Confrontation Clause by allowing an expert to transmit testimonial hearsay, shielding the testimonial testing analyst from the crucible of confrontation. Here, Dr. Smith relayed testimonial hearsay in the form of the eighth test and the result, as well as through the presentation of the Brooks analyst statements in the Brooks laboratory report. He parroted the AFIP analyst's conclusions, and these errors materially prejudiced appellant's substantial rights. Appellant respectfully requests that this honorable court would set aside the finding in the sentence.
Thank you, counsel, and we thank both counsel for the parties for your presentation today. We thank counsel for the amicus for your presentation. The case is now submitted. Shortly, the clerk will recess the court pending further order of the court, and at that point we will remain in place in an informal session for an opportunity to have a Q&A dialogue with the audience.
On bus, the court stands adjourned until further order of the court. Please be seated.